Welcome to the Business of Being You podcast. My name is Marco Benitez, also known as Coach Marco B. I'm a certified coach specializing in burnout and authenticity coaching. In this podcast, I share insights, reflections, and on an episode like today, conversations with people who not only chose to live a life that's authentic to them, but decided to help people be authentic themselves. Today, I'm thrilled to have a conversation with Dr. Amber Kintzer. She's a communication expert, consultant, coach, and confidence builder. She has a PhD in communication and works with leaders and others to help them increase their communication skills, savvy, and confidence to transform how they lead, manage, and collaborate. As a professional in higher education who has learned to manage her lifelong struggle with imposter self-concept, she coaches others based on imposterism research, her experiential knowledge, and effective management strategies. She too uses these strategies in her everyday life to live more fully, boldly, and authentically. Dr. Amber, thank you for being here with me. Welcome to the Business of Being You podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity. I'm excited.
I'm so excited today as well. This topic of imposter syndrome is so important, especially around the topic of or the theme of authenticity, which is central to the work that I do in coaching and the central message within the podcast. When I talk about authenticity with people who feel like they have challenges being their authentic self or showing up as their authentic self, this feeling of being an imposter shows up very often. Mm-hmm. So I wanted you to really delve into this and share your expertise. And I want to start with the basics. For the viewers who have heard the term imposter syndrome, but are not 100% sure what that is. So can you tell us exactly what is imposter syndrome and what does it look like?
Okay. Imposter syndrome is a sort of a popular term that's been used to talk about imposterism or imposter phenomenon or maybe imposter self-concept. And imposterism is living with the belief that we are not competent or capable enough to be in the position we're in, that we're not deserving of our accomplishments as we seem, and that any minute someone's going to peg us as a fraud. So let me say, though, that most people have felt, you know, in their life, in over their head, or, you know, like moments where they haven't felt competent enough, like, oh my gosh, people are going to find out that I don't know what I'm doing. Most people have experienced imposter feelings. That's, you know, various points in their lives. But for some people, imposterism is this persistent, sometimes daily struggle, sometimes even incapacitating struggle. And that's what I focus on.
Got it. You and I trained in the same coaching discipline, if you will. And we talk about different energetic blocks or things that get in the way of people moving forward towards the things that they want. One of the most intimate blocks that we learned about that we coach our clients on is what we call the gremlin, also known as the internal self-critic. Is imposterism the same as this gremlin self-critic, or are there differences?
I think that imposterism is one of the tricks of the gremlin self-critic. Mm. Gremlins, of course, spend plenty of time telling you that you're not good enough, that you're not worthy, and imposterism is certainly connected to that. So, in fact, one of the things that I suggest for folks, which I'll be talking about later, is a kind of naming that gremlin. And I have a strategy for how to deal with that. But I think they're very connected.
Do you work with people more so in a business setting or in working with imposterism in their personal lives?
Well, I work with people in both. Most people who come to me are struggling with it at work. That's where they sort of notice it the most, because they feel most kind of measured in that environment. But it absolutely spills over into everyday life outside of work. So sometimes it's really finally difficult to talk about imposter syndrome only at work. Most of the research that's been done on imposterism has focused on people who are successful at work, but who do not believe that they are successful and who do not believe that they are worthy of the accomplishments.
Are there prevalences?
We do see some. In fact, we see sort of social group prevalences in imposterism. I'm careful to say that, to not say that women have imposter syndrome or that people of color have imposter syndrome, like it's some kind of thing inside them that they have and can't get rid of, but rather I talk about them as struggling with it. If you're from a non-dominant social group, then you've been getting persistent messages throughout life about not measuring up to, you know, to the dominant group, and the things that you are successful in, you are things that don't really matter that much. So it's not all that surprising that women and people of color and people with a disability and people who are non-binary, that they would struggle with feelings of being judged and feeling like they may come up lacking if the standard is that, you know, of the dominant group.
Got it. So for a person who's listening to this right now, and now it feels like something's brewing, I think that this may be me. What does imposterism look like in the professional setting and in the personal setting?
Imposterism takes a couple of forms. The primary is that you are concerned always with feeling like you're not measuring up, feeling like people are going to find out that you don't know what you're doing. People who struggle with imposterism use the phrase, I don't know what I'm doing, or everybody's going to find out I don't know what I'm doing, frequently. Mm. And of course, that self-talk has an impact. But if someone feels like in a persistent way, like they just can't do enough in order to feel competent, then they might take a look at whether imposterism is a factor there. People who are struggling with imposterism have a cluster of habits that keep imposterism in place. One of them is overworking because they're trying so hard to prove that they're worthy and that they're competent. So they put more energy into a project or a presentation than is really called for. Then they take that work home and start focusing on perfectionist tendencies. So someone struggling with imposterism is doing a lot of overworking, probably. And the second one is avoidance, which is trying to stay out of situations where you might come up lacking. So sometimes people struggling with imposterism will stay away from opportunities where they could be growing or they could be moving into new directions. But with each new opportunity, of course, comes a whole new host of people who might figure out that they don't know what they're doing. Mm. So they will stay away from opportunities, anything, moments where they may be judged. And they just sort of can't abide that because they're pretty convinced that they're going to come up lacking. So right. Overwork and avoidance are what Jessamy Hibbard, who wrote the book The Imposter Cure, calls the imposter twins. Those are two of the primary habits. And another one is that they misinterpret mistakes or setbacks as proof that they're not competent or that they're not worthy of accomplishment, rather than as the opportunities that they are to grow. So people who aren't dealing with imposterism go, oh, yeah, you're right. Thanks for giving me that feedback. I'm gonna work on that. I need to update that or something. People who are struggling with imposterism say, I knew it. I'm not competent. I knew I didn't know what I was doing. So they see these sometimes feedback from other people and sometimes their own mistakes or setbacks as proof that they're incompetent instead of proof that they have opportunity for growth.
Interesting. And I see a lot of correlation to perfectionism, in that people with perfectionism tendencies, they tend to catastrophize things. So the feedback that you were talking about, it's something small that could have been delivered with the intention of constructive criticism, but it was received as a reflection as their own shortcomings.
Right.
And also the person with perfectionism, they equate the quality of their work to their own personal value.
Correct. Yep.
And so from what I'm hearing is that the compensatory behavior, so to speak, would be to overwork and also delve into to overcompensating, sometimes going into perfectionism, and also playing small. And this might look like maybe not speaking up in meetings, not volunteering for things that one might really want to do, but they feel intimidated or they may feel revealed.
Exactly. So those are the imposter twins, overwork and avoidance. And what you're talking about is avoiding opportunity or avoiding instances where I might be judged.
Are there any statistics that share the prevalence of imposterism within the workforce or in people in general?
Well, that research is developing all the time. So it's really hard to identify a number, especially because, you know, just about everybody has feelings of imposterism at various points in their life. So whether or not we're saying someone is struggling mightily with imposterism is going to depend on kind of how we measure it at a given time. The main thing is trying to determine whether or not someone is incapacitated by it or is missing life opportunities because of it. And I don't know the statistics for that.
Right. I would imagine it's difficult because so much of this is probably hidden. A lot of people don't want to admit to it.
Right. It's very, very much an internal struggle. And sometimes that gets shared with loved ones. In fact, the thing is that a person who struggles with imposterism a lot of times is actually very successful and looks to other people like they're totally on top of it and totally confident, which is how they're able to accomplish these things. But internally, there's, you know, plagued with doubt. And, you know, they sort of, when they accomplish one thing, they kind of say, well, yeah, I could do that, but I wouldn't be able to do the next thing. And so then if they try to do the next thing and they succeed in that, then they say, well, yeah, I mean, I could do that, but I couldn't do the next. So things get, when they accomplish something, that gets denigrated in their mind as not all that big of a deal.
So have you found that there are certain factors that lead a person to develop, I don't know if the right term is an imposter persona, mm-hmm. But have you found that there are certain factors that lead a person down that road? And if so, how does recognizing those factors help them in overcoming imposterism?
I'd say, I mean, there are lots of factors and, you know, lots of combinations of factors. But I would say there are sort of three primary categories of influences on imposter self-concept: familial, personal, and social. And so by familial, I'm talking about someone who grows up in an environment where they got persistent messages that they're just not good enough, and that they're not smart enough or thin enough or pretty enough or strong enough. If you grew up in a family environment where that was a persistent message, it will be difficult for you to not develop feelings of not measuring up. And then that's kind of gateway to feeling like an imposter. If you grew up in an environment with parental rage and abuse, like I did, then meeting very precise expectations, even if you don't know what those expectations are, proves dangerous. So, of course, you're very wary of not measuring up and not doing enough and never doing things quite right. And then that opens up opportunities for imposterism to develop. Maybe some folks, even regardless of childhood experience, aren't getting approval from their family in their adult life for their adult choices. And it's not, you know, you're not getting approval for whatever your profession choices, your partner choices, your parenting choices. Some folks are dealing with ridicule or a lack of approval from family for their adult choices. So that's familial. But I think it's important to realize that we, you know, most of us who struggle with imposter feelings developed that sense of imposterism as a self-protection mechanism, right? So if I'm ever doubtful that I'm doing the right thing, then I'm always, wary and trying hard to do the right thing, which may save me from ridicule or may save me from, abuse or sort of verbal denigration or something like that. So it makes sense that they would develop that as a self-protection mechanism. But then when we get to adult life, those factors aren't in play anymore a lot of times. And so we're still acting out of imposterism when we don't really need that self-protective mechanism right. of imposter feelings anymore. And, but it's a, you know, sometimes a lifelong habit, lifelong series of habits, and they're very difficult to break. Sometimes they can be addressed with coaching. Sometimes they need therapy. So familial is one, personal is another one. So maybe certain personality types or other psychological characteristics like depression and anxiety can lend themselves to imposterism. And then lastly is the one we already talked about, social, which is if you're from a non-dominant social group and you get the message that you're not as competent as or worthy as other groups, or the thing that you're competent in doesn't matter, then it's simple. It makes sense that you might develop some imposter feelings from that.
Right. Something you mentioned reminded me of something that I read some time back, in that when we worry or we focus on the negative, I think what I was reading had to do about why do people tend to focus more on their fears and what could go wrong? Why is that so much easier to do than focusing on a more positive outcome? And they mentioned how this goes back to our time as cavemen, in that if there were two siblings and one was very aloof and just not paying attention, they were more susceptible to being attacked by the proverbial saber-toothed lion,
right?
Saber-toothed tiger. As opposed to the person who's always on alert and on guard, they would have more of the edge for survival because they were anticipating the negative.
Indeed.
It doesn't serve us now as much right. as it did before.
Sure.
But what you mentioned reminded me of that. There's a saying in coaching that says, we coach who we once were. And I'm curious if there's something in your personal journey that you'd be willing to share that you felt kind of moved you into helping people with imposterism.
I have been struggling with imposterism for so much of my life, I can't even. I've been living with that for much of my young adult and adult life, though, as I mentioned, it had its early roots in my childhood with a rageaholic father. Whose judgment, could mean very dangerous things for me and my siblings. And then, if I didn't accomplish things around the house in a way that he thought was good enough, I was punished. So I lived, super wary about not meeting expectations. And so just to be on the safe side, I guess I assumed that, it's possible that whatever I did might suddenly be found out as not good enough. So I had to kind of overachieve in whatever dimensions I could. But and then another thing that happened is the converse of that, which is when I did well, that was a problem too, because I had a sister who had some learning disabilities, and we weren't using the language of learning disabilities at that time. It was just, sort of bootstraps kind of right. get on it sort of discipline. So I made pretty good grades in school. And if I came home with a good, if it was report card time, my father was, you know, a rageaholic and abusive. And so my mother, to protect my sibling who struggled with schoolwork, would just sign the report cards and sort of secretly send them off to school so that my dad would not know that it was report card time. So what I learned from that is that, you know, doing well isn't all that impressive. It's just sort of a secret. And that if I were to sort of claim my academic accomplishments, it would have been dangerous for my sister. So I learned to not put much stock in my own accomplishments because it made other people feel bad or it meant bad things for them. So in some ways I was kind of, I was pretty primed to develop imposterism from my childhood. But I saw it emerge, I think, when I went away to, I was born and raised in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And I went to University of South Florida for my four-year degree. I started out at community college and then got my associate's degree. And then I was going over to University of South Florida for my bachelor's degree. And I didn't, my parents had moved out of state right at the same time. I didn't have any support system there. I was 2 years older because I had worked for 2 years, 2 years older than most of the people I was in classes with and that I shared the dorm with. So I just felt out of place all around. And didn't really have a support system. My family was not, you know, I was the first one to get a 4 year degree. And, so I felt out of place and unsupported there. So I just kept working harder and harder and harder and harder, trying to prove to me and, others that I did belong at a four-year institution and wasn't out of my league, which is how I felt once I left the community college. And then it just sort of, developed from there. What's sort of surprising to me is that I kept going to the next level. So I got my bachelor's degree and then got into a master's program. And that at that level, I thought now, I mean, I literally thought this is where they're going to find out. I don't know what I'm doing. I don't, somehow I got past the bachelor's degree tests and now they're going to find out. And so then I got through the classes and then we had, you know, exams, comprehensive exams. And I thought, okay, you can get to the classes, but you're not going to be able to get through the comprehensive exams. I mean, you're not going to be able to do that. And then I got through those. And then, it was, well, you're not going to be able to get into a PhD program. And I got in, well, you can get in, but you can't, you know, so I just have been doing that my whole life, my whole adult life. And it wasn't until I was in this, I was giving a talk to, Watauga Counseling Association about, sort of gender development. And this was after when I became a professor and all through it, you know, you'll get the PhD, but you won't be able to get a job. Okay. You'll get a job, but you won't be able to keep it, you know, like that kind of stuff. And so I was giving this talk and then all of a sudden I had this kind of third eye experience where I was watching myself give this talk. And I thought, I know exactly what I'm talking about. And it was so sort of shocking. And I thought, I think I might know some things. So that was really, you know, PhD later. And that was the moment when I thought, maybe I know a thing or two. Could it be that I know some things? But that was so, that was my first moment of feeling like maybe I had some knowledge that was worth sharing.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
That's very interesting that you describe that. It sounds like what we talk about, again, referencing our coaching training, the level seven moments where we're both, we're simultaneously the observer and the participant. And what's very interesting is For me, I have experienced those moments when I'm having deep conversations with people, but not conversations in a back and forth engaging sense. It's more where someone has come to me with a problem or a trouble, a coaching client, and this wisdom, I say humbly, this wisdom just starts to flow. And what's really fascinating is that I feel myself go back and up. It's so weird. Back and up. It's almost a little tunnel vision. So it's almost as though whatever I'm watching gets pulled back, my field of vision. And there, in those moments, I'm saying things that I have never thought of or said before. I've never thought that thought. It wasn't something like, oh, this is something good I'm going to use. I've never thought it before. I've never said it before. And I'm hearing myself say it for the first time, but I'm the one saying it. Right, and then there's a separate thought where I'm like, man, this is some good stuff. I got to write this down.
Somebody should write this down.
Someone should write this down. I should write it down. But it sounds similar to what you're describing.
Yeah, it does. It does sound similar. You just sort of want to get the notes of the people who watched you talk so you can.
Right. Like, so is anyone taking notes?
I know what you said.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Wow. And they're beautiful moments because, at least for myself, and I'm curious if you've had the same experience, but afterwards, when you come down off of that high, if you will, it just lasts. For me, this moment of it's almost a moment of, it's a moment of bliss immediately afterwards. And it's just happiness and peace and tranquility, but it lasts throughout the entire day. I don't know if that's what it felt like for you.
Well, I would say, as someone who struggles mightily with imposterism, that lasts probably a shorter amount of time before I start going into, yeah, that was great, but remember that one thing when you stumbled, and, you know, so sort of going back into self-criticism.
Right.
It's like, it's sort of like, it's self-protective in that it's like, if I can get to the criticism first, then I won't be hurt by someone else criticizing me, because I've already raked myself over the coals for that, you know, so I'm not going to be caught off guard. And then also, if I can, the myth is, if I can pinpoint every single mistake, then I can fix them for next time, and then it will be perfect, which of course is not possible.
Right.
But that doesn't stop me from trying.
Of course. That's the beauty of it. You know, that makes you awesome. So we talked a lot about how this would really affect you in your professional life. I'm curious, in personal relationships, how is it, what is its effect in a personal relationship setting, having an imposter persona?
Well, you know, you don't, as I said, most of the research is on sort of workplace success, but you know, you can't turn that off. It's not like you leave work and you come home and now all of a sudden you feel like, you know, top of the world sort of thing.
Right.
One of the things that we do inadvertently is we insult people, and we don't mean to. And what I'm talking about is, people will compliment us and we don't know what to do with that because we don't believe it, and it feels really uncomfortable. It feels false. So you don't want to be around that falseness. So you sort of denigrate the person's compliment by saying, oh, it was nothing, or were you at the same talk that I was at? Ha ha, you know, or well, I don't, a good thing so-and-so wasn't there, because then I would have been judged negatively, or something like that. So we don't know what to do with positive comments. And in our effort to sort of deal with imposterism by saying, no, I don't deserve that, what we're actually doing is telling the person they're not a good judge of people. And it's insulting.
Right.
Which we don't mean, but we still do that. So that's one of the ways it carries over. Also, if we have people that we're close to who know that we struggle with imposterism, we can exhaust them. it's exhausting for the person who feels like an imposter anyway, because they're having to work to keep from being discovered and to always turn out stellar work and self-critique and then try to fix it and all of that. It's a very exhausting life. But if we let people that we care about in on, you know, I really struggle with feeling worthy or feeling like I deserve this thing, or maybe we know the language of imposter syndrome or imposterism. And then we put the people that we care about in the position of always having to build us up, which is exhausting for them and not their responsibility, finally, right? I mean, it's nice to have people around who can build you up. That's a good thing. That's a good, loving thing to do. But if we put the people that we care about constantly in the position of having to tell us that we're worthy, that robs them of opportunities to live our relationship in a freer, more rewarding way. And they spend a lot of their energy building us up. And that can be negative. Imposterism flows over into social life, in, you know, personal life, by doing things like, you know, bringing work home all the time, spending your personal time overworking, spending your relationship time overworking. You go to out of town with your partner. And you've got a bag of work that you're bringing with you because you've got to always stay on top of everything. So you overwork there. Maybe you even, in terms of like friendships and your friendship network, let's say you have a dinner party and you spend far more time on that dinner party than is called for, working to be perfect. I'm not satisfied with it. When you get complimented, you brush it off, say it was nothing, or that, yeah, well, some of it was store-bought. Oh, I've been cooking that for a long time. It wasn't any big deal. So there we go, inadvertently insulting people again. But overworking investing far more energy in it. And then what happens is the dinner party comes, people come, and you're exhausted and you can't enjoy the party.
Right.
Because you've used up all your energy making it absolutely perfect. And then another way is that you'll avoid friendships because maybe you're convinced you're terrible at it, or that person won't want to be your friend, or you don't branch out and have a network of friends because the more people that you're acquainted with, the more people there are who can detect that you're fake. So you maybe restrict your friendship network. So it can spill over into personal life and relationships in very notable ways.
Right. It's very clear that imposter syndrome, imposterism, it's almost an authenticity killer. You know, I don't know that anything would kill authenticity, so to speak, because it's in there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a huge block. So we talked a lot about the problem. I love talking about solutions. So let's start with, like, what are the big high level, the broad strokes, if you will, to begin to overcome imposterism? And is there something that we should identify first off that would lead us into beginning to address it in the most effective manner?
I think what we're trying to do is move from autopilot in how we respond to making a conscious choice about how we respond. That's what we're essentially what we're trying to do. I've got this quote on the top of my computer by Viktor Frankl, which says, "Between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space is our power to choose our response. And in our response lies our growth and our freedom." So between that feeling like an imposter and then doing self-talk that convinces you that you're an imposter, there's a space. So what we're trying to do is expand that space a little bit so you have time and energy to devote to trying to think of an alternative response. So that's the big picture thing that we're trying to do. And it would start with, for me, of course, as a communication specialist, it's all about communication. And so the first thing would be how you communicate to yourself and about yourself, because language and self-talk matter enormously. They create neural pathways or block new neural pathways. One of the things to do is to learn to assign new labels for some of what you're feeling. So, for example, if you feeling nervous or feeling super anxious, before I would, let's say, give a presentation, and then I learned from a friend to use the language of adrenaline rush. She said, "What if what you're feeling is an adrenaline rush because you're going to speak in front of other people and you want to do it well?" And I thought, that sounds much less judgmental and much more surmountable than nervousness and anxiousness, which kind of pulls you back a little bit. But an adrenaline rush kind of, you know, moves you forward. So thinking about language like, I'm just really motivated. I want to do a good job. I'm excited about speaking tonight. I've got this adrenaline rush for this presentation I have to give, instead of I'm so nervous, I'm so anxious. And then, you know, beneath the surface of that is because this is when they're going to find out when I don't know what I'm doing. So assigning new labels for some of those sort of physiological responses. And then in your language, focusing on what you're doing versus what you are being versus who you are as a human being. And you and I talked about this a few minutes ago. Let's say if we go back to this idea of the presentation, you finish and you realize there were some parts that needed some improvement. Somebody who's really struggling with imposterism is going to say it was a flop. I blew it. And so instead of using that language, which is an authenticity blocker, as you were saying, use the language of, I did not give a lot of examples, and I realized that people wanted, as I was speaking, I realized that people wanted more examples. So next time I'm going to provide more examples. So you're focusing more on the activity, which you can change, as opposed to who you are and what this, you know, supposed failure says about you as a human being. And those are the large places that people who are struggling with imposterism go to. And all of this is a part of speaking to yourself with compassion versus criticism. Jessamy Hibbert says that compassion is the antidote to self-criticism. And trying to say, boy, I was really struggling with the conclusion of that presentation, or I was really struggling with how to present my ideas to my supervisor, as opposed to, you know, I blew it. I did a terrible job. Oh my gosh, I made a fool of myself. It's so much more compassionate to say I was struggling. I mean, one of the things I learned from my own therapist was to talk to yourself like you would talk to a friend who brought this to you. And you would say, you were just struggling with it. It's not, you didn't blow it. You had a little trouble with this part of the, what you were presenting, and you can fix that. You can improve that. That's not, you're not a terrible presenter. So using that language of compassion that you would use for someone else towards yourself can be helpful. And then that last thing about communicating to yourself is changing the narratives that we recite to ourselves. So people who struggle with imposterism will credit other things to their successes to other things. So they'll say it was luck. It was timing. I was just in the right place at the right time. It wasn't really because of anything I did. I just happened to be in the right place at the right time. That, well, I knew some people who knew some people, so it wasn't really me. It was really those connections. Maybe they say, well, they liked me. It was my personality. It wasn't really, you know, what I did. It was just people tend to like me. So I get stuff. I get recognitions. You know, the subtext there is ones that I don't deserve. And then saying that they were just being nice. People were just being nice. I wasn't really that good. So the person who struggles with imposterism has a whole bunch of ways to counter the evidence that they're doing fine with these kinds of, you know, these kinds of things. And then sometimes this is something I did for a long time, which is just sort of joking about your imposter syndrome. Well, you know, imposter syndrome, I feel like an imposter, ha ha ha. And not doing anything about it for a long time, just using it as fodder for a joke. And, you know me, always feeling like an imposter, and then not doing anything about it. And so it wasn't until the last couple of years, actually, that I started realizing I didn't have to just live with it, that I could actually, undo it. Mm. And communicating to yourself and about yourself to other people is one of the ways that you can do that. Another one is interpreting the communication of how others respond to you. So people struggling with imposterism will see, for example, criticism. I mean, they see praise as false and they see criticism as debilitating. So it's really a catch-22 for your friends and family. They don't know how to respond. You don't accept either one of them. People with struggling with imposterism will see mistakes as a sign of, comment about the whole person, as a message about total incompetence as a person, instead of opportunities for growth. And they see criticism as, you're sort of taking me out, taking me down as a human being, instead of, no, I'm just actually talking about this one thing that it would be good for you to work on. And we see failures as, a failure of personhood rather than a particular task. But what we have to do is sort of adopt a growth mindset. And I've recently came across a quote by Nelson Mandela. He says, "I never lose. I either win or learn." Mm-hmm. I mean, golden.
All right.
And I think that's that. If a person struggling with imposterism could recite that enough times, they might get to a point where they can see the growth opportunity. We learned this in some of our coaching training. There are no mistakes. There's only opportunity. So seeing criticism as a thing that needs work rather than you need work as a person. Back to that, what you're doing versus, what you're being.
All right.
And then the last strategy is just a small low key strategy, but it's really quite helpful. It was similar to our coaching training when we had to name our gremlin. Mm. And it's I've got a couple of imposter writers talk about this, and it was I'm talking about Jessamy Hibbard, Jill Stoddard, Valerie Young, and the idea is that you give this external voice. To like in coaching school, we did like a visual image, but they talk about giving a like an auditory voice to this imposter voice. And some suggested giving it a computerized voice. In coaching school, we learned that the gremlin always talks in a child's voice because it emerged in childhood. Yeah. So you imagine this little child who doesn't really know a lot telling you, petulantly, what you're good at or what you're not good at. Jessamy Hibbard talks about assigning a yappy dog, voice to this thing to minimize it and make it less significant and less powerful. My gremlin, my imposter voice is Parcher, who is a character in A Beautiful Mind, the Ed Harris character. He's always slinking in the background. But what really helped me, I learned how to keep him in the background, or I'm learning how to keep him in the background. But what really helped me was giving him a child's voice. This little sort of high-pitched child's voice. And now, I mean, it really has disempowered this previously very powerful character in my life to be this sort of petulant child. Another option is to see it as a cartoon kid. And you could say, I mean, it's not real. So you can say, stop it. You're not even real. I don't have to listen to you. So those are three, how you talk about yourself, how you interpret how other people communicate with you, and then assigning that external voice. Those are three sort of overarching strategies that a person can use. But that, you know, it takes time. It takes time to undo that imposter mindset. It really takes time and a lot of times coaching or counseling.
Right. And it sounds like it could be even a lifelong journey that one does not necessarily ever cure imposter syndrome, but one learns how to control it or to compartmentalize it enough that it doesn't have as big a hold or influence as it did before you tried to implement some strategies.
Right. I think that's true. I don't think mine will ever go away. It's so interwoven into so much of my childhood and then so much of my adult life. I don't think that will go away, but I did learn and I am continuing to learn how to manage that and how to lower the volume on that imposter voice so that it doesn't have this sort of thunderous, impact. I can keep that in the background so I can say to myself, oh, this is my, imposter habit. This is my self-doubting habit. This is not my truth. This is my habit. And I can adopt, you know, I can do something else.
Do you find that this is something that can be passed on to the children, this mindset? Because so many other unhealthy behaviors can continue the cycle. I'm curious if you find that this is something that can also be passed on in the way people, you know, raise their kids.
I think it depends on how much of that becomes external. So a lot of the burden of imposterism is carried internally. And sometimes other people don't know. People are usually surprised when I identify as having imposter syndrome. Because apparently I don't communicate that. Now, in terms of my kids, they know because I talk about it now, but it would depend on how much I externalized my self-doubt. I suppose in some ways, if I, you know, avoided opportunities for growth or advancement or something, then I might teach them to avoid those opportunities. But whether it got entangled with imposterism depends on how much I guess I've said out loud.
You did mention about people working with you, and I'm curious for people that were informed, enlightened, and who now want to really take this imposter syndrome and begin to move away from it. How can people find you, work with you to begin to do that?
Okay. They can find me on my website, amberkinzer.com. They can find me on LinkedIn. And I would love to talk with folks.
Awesome. Awesome. And I'm going to leave links to all of that in the description.
I guess, but you know, the last thing I would say is imposter feelings are normal. Lots of people have them. They're normal. They're not freaky, but they are not truths. As they say, feelings aren't facts. And so you can both feel like an imposter and know that that's not true. And so the counseling or the coaching can help you to see the ways in which that's not true. Hmm.
And I like to close with all my guests with this question. What does authenticity mean to you?
To me, living authentically means having really wrestled with the extent to which your expectations for yourself are grounded in your own values or whether they are grounded in the values you've been taught you should have. And so learning to pursue a life that, according to your own chosen values, is living authentically.
Well, Dr. Amber, it was a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for your insight and your information and for your tips and for being so open with us and being authentic.
Thank you, Coach Marco B. I really appreciate the opportunity to be on the show. Thank you.
It was a pleasure. And I have plans for another conversation for us. So I'm looking forward to that.
I'm looking forward to that one.
Absolutely. And for those who are watching this episode, listening to it on audio, tell me about what your experience and your journey with imposterism has been like. Tell me in the comments. And I'll see you in the next episode. But remember, don't forget to mind your business, the business of being you.